This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support is from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. We start our show today with the president of the Louisiana Family Forum, Gene Mills, and he is a busy bee at the state capitol. Yesterday, a historic veto override session began, and a bill banning transgender athletes from girls' sports was the only successful challenge on the first day. Another measure was one that would allow for concealed carry of guns without a permit. That one only received 23 votes in the Senate, 26 votes necessary. And the transgender measure did receive 26, exactly two-thirds of the senators of the 39-member chamber. Ronnie John's absent, so it was 26 to 12. 877-217-5757 is your number. And talk at talklouisiana.org is our email address. Reverend Mills, good morning to you.
Good morning, Jim. It's good to be with you.
Nice to talk with you. What is your assessment of day one of this historic session?
Well, it is historic. I think there are a number of uncertainties, not the least of which the rules that must be followed, whether or not a bill could be pulled up for reconsideration, where the members may come down on any given vote, notwithstanding how they voted in the regular session, and the energy and the earnest of the fourth floor to protect their vetoes, and all of which make for an interesting combination. Somewhat unpredictable, too.
Well, let's start with the gun bill. That one was a majority, 23 to 15, but it takes two-thirds to override a veto. In fact, two-thirds in both chambers. Are you saying that because it was a majority vote, it could be reconsidered?
Well, there was a question as to whether or not a measure can, because in the regular session, reconsideration is allowed on a two-thirds vote. The rules are not as clear in what is now the first ever veto override session outside of a regular session since our new constitution. So that would really be a parliamentarian call or recommendation, and then the speaker or the Senate president who would call it. There is some legal debate.
Yeah. Do you like that bill?
I certainly don't oppose it. The demographics are much narrower. I believe that law-abiding citizens are not the ones who are a threat to either the police or to the general public. It's those who do not respect the law. And I think that's what the author had in mind when he moved the measure.
Well, that one at this point looks like it's a long shot at best, and some are saying it's dead on arrival. But the other one, not the same scenario. It could pass as far as overriding the governor's veto. It's got another chamber to go, a chamber in which the Republican majority does not have a supermajority, but nonetheless, 68 out of 70 members of the House are Republicans who would be normally inclined to vote to override the Democratic governor. But you definitely are passionate about the transgender measure. Why?
Well, we believe that there is a legitimate moral concern when you attempt to enforce fairness or enforce, which, by the way, we support. We just don't believe that you erase mistreatment of a few by discriminating or mistreating a whole class of people. We think the best way to accomplish that is biology answers the question, and it creates a fair and equal playing field when it comes to competitive sports.
Well, Karen Carter Peterson, senator from New Orleans, who, as we know, recently ran for Congress and was not successful, she made her case that the governor's veto should stick. And here's what Senator Peterson said from the floor.
You can't have it both ways. You either want business to come to Louisiana or you want to discriminate. We're about to make a decision. Do we want to grow our economy? Do we want to recover from this pandemic? Or do we want to discriminate? It's going to be crystal clear. But it's not just corporations that will snub us. It's also major sporting events. Maybe that will move you. Or concerts and visitors.
All right. That's Karen Carter Peterson, who says the state will lose important business opportunities, perhaps even the Final Four. Is that a concern, or should that even be weighed in your estimation, Reverend Mills?
No, I think when you're dealing with public policy, it's up to elected representatives to weigh all the factors. Senator Peterson has never been a spokesperson for business and industry, and she historically has scored very poorly on what they consider to be actual economic development. I think the threat by the NCAA or any other non-elected body should not be taken into consideration when deciding how do you create and maintain a fair and equitable playing field. And we believe biology matters in those questions.
877-217-5757. We'll take a few calls for Reverend Mills if things go according to plan. But please be respectful. I know this is an issue that has incited passion, and Reverend Mills is speaking as a sincere messenger from one side, and we hope if you are in disagreement with him that you'll be courteous to him, even if you disagree. Jim and Walker. Hi, Jim. You're on with Gene Mills.
Yeah, Mr. Mills, I'd like you to name exactly one instance where this has happened, because other than that, you are, in fact, doing exactly what you said that you believed that you didn't want to do, which is discriminate against an entire class of people.
All right. Does Gene have a, or excuse me, Jim have a point, Gene?
Well, it certainly is a valid question. And Jim, thank you for those kind thoughts as it relates to a civil dialogue. I, too, respect that we can disagree, but do it in a civil and respectful manner. I think there are two things. Number one, it's happening all over the country. In Colorado or in Connecticut, three boys entered female categories and won 15 state championships and set 17 new records in only 3 years. And every time a boy enters a female category, or a man does, they displace a woman. Now, some have said, well, that's not in Louisiana. Well, John Bell said that, too, and he said this was a solution in search of a problem. I respectfully disagree, and I remind John Bell and your listening audience that in 2016, he issued an executive order, 2016-11, which forced girls to accept boys in ladies' locker rooms. And it was only the attorney general's intervention in a lawsuit that stopped him.
All right.
John Bell appealed that three times and lost it all the way to the state Supreme Court. So the problem came when John Bell came to office and introduced this concept. And for him to say otherwise is misleading.
On the statement you made about boys competing against girls, if somebody's transgender, they're not a boy. There is a distinction. Granted, but they're not a boy. They are at the same gender as the other people they're competing with. Is that a concern for you?
Yeah, that's an ocean of difference between science, biology, medical facts, precedent, history, and law. So what you just say is theoretical and speculative at best. But to introduce that boy or girl into this category displaces those. You don't fix mistreatment if it exists. And the governor says it doesn't. LHSAA says we have rules in place, but we support Beth Mizell's Fairness in Women's Sports because it's a reasonable measure. As I understand it, the superintendents of school boards have as well. So, no, I respectfully disagree. I don't think that that science has caught up with that social belief.
All right.
And by the way, society doesn't believe it.
Well,
to the tune of 75 or 80%. They hold clearly that common sense and biology answer that question much clearer than some of our sexual political advocate friends.
Well, there was a time, as we know, that 75 or 80% of the country believed in slavery, too, and we know that to be bad.
That's a bit of an unfair comparison, Jim. You know, you're dealing with a category of people that are actually here. You're dealing with women, a woman who's displaced. There is an Olympian out of New Zealand right now that's bumped a number of people off the medal category or the ability to compete because of an unfair advantage in bone density, lung size, muscular structure, notwithstanding surgeries or testosterone or hormone treatment. They still have a capacity that is estimated between 10 to 50% advantage over their counterparts in a female category. That's undeniable, and it's actual science.
But has any transgender person won a gold medal? I, I, I don't think there's a whole lot of this going around. You mentioned a few cases, and by the way, there's some transgender athletes who compete and don't win. Not everybody wins. It's like people who are competing as they were born. Some win, some don't. It's not a given, but you're saying it's an unfair advantage. Many agree with you. Some disagree. Patrick in Oswald Estates, before we go to the break, let's slide you in. Patrick, good morning.
Yeah, he just made my point, and that is, okay, so if a transgender is a girl, like you claim, Jim, they still were a boy at one time, and they have the bone density, the muscle mass that they had from when they were a boy, which gives them an unfair advantage in women's sports. Even if they're a girl now, they still got an unfair advantage.
877-217-5757, but there are some people who are girls who have more bone density than other girls. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Historic veto override session started yesterday. Governor John Bel Edwards will be with us at 2 o'clock for Ask the Governor. Vetoed 28 bills from the recent regular session, all of which could be challenged. But so far, the only one it looks like that could be overridden is the transgender measure. And Gene Mills is with us for a few more moments. Reverend Mills is passionate about this, believing that people who are trans have an unfair advantage over women in athletic competitions. Mary Patricia Ray writes, Reverend Mills is relying on biology and common sense, but biology is very clear that X and Y chromosome combinations aren't just XX or XY. The fact alone makes biological sex not black and white. Relying on false information to inform a decision that spreads hate is the opposite of what the Christian church teaches us. Are you concerned, Reverend Mills, that this could cause a backlash and have people discriminated more than they already are and face
Jim,
retribution?
To which I would say nobody's in favor of anything other than fairness. This bill is about fairness. It is about creating a shield of protection, not a sword of injury. And to Patrick's question earlier, in a single year, 275 high school boys ran faster times than the lifetime best world champion sprinters, including Allison Felix. So, no, I would not agree. Her perception that the genetic anomaly of a mismatch chromosome is a category other than a genetic anomaly, and that's not whom we're speaking of. We're speaking of those who, by professional intervention, coaching and counseling, and other activists, both in the medical field and otherwise, are encouraging kids to go through transitionary treatments that are radical. I think the real untold story and the problem you're going to have later is this idea that my problem is I'm a girl or my problem is I'm a boy. And then when they reach an age of a later age and they realize the problems they were grappling with were not solved by the surgical interventions or the hormone treatments.
All right. But there are people of all ages who undergo this, Bruce Jenner being the prime example. He was in his 50s and is now Caitlyn Jenner, and I doubt that Caitlyn Jenner is as fast or as strong as Bruce Jenner was. 877-217-5757. David in Atlanta, you're on with Reverend Mills. Hi, David.
Good morning, gentlemen. I'm not surprised Reverend Mills is opposed to this any discrimination bill, because in general, Reverend Mills would oppose gays, lesbians, and transsexuals being discriminated against in areas like housing and education and marriage. So the fact is, I don't think Reverend Mills would ever support anything that would bring gay people, lesbians, and transsexuals closer to being first-class citizens.
All right. Is that fair, or is that, at the very least, an exaggeration, Reverend Mills?
No, I think it's a question that people have, and that is the basis upon which we establish foundational credibility and a measure of standard that we measure things by. I don't believe in special rights for a few, and I think you're doing that in this case. I think it ought to be equality for all, and the manner in which that equality is determined has to be a standard outside of perception. In this case, it's biology, and I don't see the link. Marriage is a distinct product of the Christian church. It's the reason I feel strongly that what Christ said in Matthew 19, to add to his golden rule that we ought to treat all men the same way we would like to be treated.
All right, Seth in Lafayette. Seth, you're on with Reverend Mills. Hi, Seth.
Hey, Mr. Jim. I'm just calling from Lafayette here. I was wondering, why can't we take it on a sport-by-sport basis and leave it up to private organizations or schools that are running these athletic competitions? And the main reason I say sport-by-sport is there was a mixed martial artist who transitioned from being a man to being a woman. And his whole life, he'd had testosterone building up his bone density, his muscle mass. He transitioned in his 20s or 30s after getting the benefit of that testosterone. And he ran through women. It was, I mean, it looked like a man beating up women.
All right. Well, what about just having individual organizations discern whether this is a good thing or not, rather than having laws that address it? Is that practical, Reverend Mills?
I don't think it's practical as a matter of public policy. We do have co-ed sports, and that is the alternative. And I think it's a healthy alternative. LHSAA is the entity that does that for the state of Louisiana, and they support the Fairness in Women's Sports measure by Beth Mizell.
A final call for Reverend Mills, Jim, and then we'll go to Jim Nickel. This is Gustavo in Goodwood. Hi, Gustavo.
Good morning. You mentioned Bruce Jenner as having gone through the transformation from a man to a woman. He hasn't done the surgery. He still has all of his male genitalia, so he hasn't.
I wouldn't know one way or the other, but it is nice that he is active. She is active. She, Caitlin, and running as a Republican, a very conservative Republican for governor of California. Will you be supporting Caitlin Jenner and her quest to unseat Gavin Newsom, Reverend Mills?
You know, I don't have a vote in California, in spite of Louisiana's very liberal voting laws or generous history of voting early and voting often. But I will echo Bruce or Caitlin has come out and said this is an obvious case of unfairness. We ought not let anybody compete outside of their biological category. And a birth certificate's a good way to tell that.
Well, thank you, as always, topical. Reverend Mills, good to talk with you. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Jim.
Bye. Jim Nickel is with us, longtime lobbyist, and prior to that, head honcho of the Louisiana Democratic Party, first executive director, and then is chair of the party, and he is following the twists and turns at the Capitol. What's your assessment of day one of this historic override session?
Well, it was interesting, to say the least. Good to be with you and your listeners, Jim, as always. You know, this is new territory for our legislature, for our governor. I don't think it's the last time we're going to see it. I think it's a natural evolution of the developments in politics in Louisiana. Your listeners are all pretty experienced, and you certainly are. The governor, whether it was a man or a woman, was in control of that building for a long, long time. And that has evolved into evolved into a much more independent legislature. And, you know, this governor's having to deal with a dynamic no other governor's had to deal with. And he's doing the best he can. They're doing the best they can. This is what the Constitution calls for. And so they're going about the process. And we all have to respect that process and let it take its course. And look, I know it's got some fits and starts because it's not a smooth calendar like we normally see during a session where bills come up for debate and we have committee reports and we have committee. This is new, and so everybody's probably a little frustrated that it's not moving quicker and that it's not either done or almost done, but that's just the nature of what we're dealing with right now. So, but they'll get through it.
But of all the bills to come back for, it looks like there'll be one bill that possibly could be overridden as far as the governor's veto, and that's this transgender measure. Is it really that important to come back for this?
Well, that's up to them. I mean, you know, it only takes a majority of both chambers to come back. But, you know, the big threshold is that 2/3 vote. And obviously, that's not easy to get to. The Senate made it on the nose. The House, anybody handicapped in the House, I'm not involved in the issues at all. I'm not in the building, would tell you it's very close. And, you know, that's not for us to determine. I get it that there are people out there that say, well, you know, this is a waste of time. We shouldn't be coming back to this one issue. It's really, that's not up to us. That's up to the legislature. They voted to do this. They have to go through this process. The And some people don't understand this, but a veto session is required by our Constitution. The only way we stay out of one is if a majority vote to not have it. And in the past, they've decided they didn't. This time, they want to come back and talk about this issue. They're doing it. We have to let the process take its course.
But the gun bill didn't make it, and some thought that one would be successful. But law enforcement, many members, including the sheriff of East Baton Rouge Parish, Sid Gautreau, they said they didn't like the bill. That persuaded Franklin Foyle, I think. What about that one? Was that a surprise, Jim?
I wasn't super surprised. I've seen some polling data on that issue. There's a significant percentage of Louisianans that think you need to have some type of permit or license. I mean, look, you got to have a fishing license. I mean, you got to have a license for a lot of things in Louisiana. And I think the public was concerned about that bill. So I'm not surprised.
We'll be back with Jim Nickel and start with Jennifer and Tara when we hit the phones after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Jim Nickel is with us, longtime Capitol watcher as a lobbyist and once as an activist with the Democratic Party. He is now involved with people on both sides of the aisle, and in Louisiana now, the state capitol is ruled by Republicans. 68 House members and 20, how many is it, Jim? It's 28 senators, I believe, are Republicans.
I believe you're right, yeah.
So that would be 96 out of 144.
Yep.
You remember when it was the other way around, but things have changed, and Governor Edwards is dealing with basically the same kind of legislature that Governor Treen dealt with. They're not largely in his camp, and as a result, they are showing their might. And in this case, if this transgender thing is not overridden, they will have overplayed their hand. And that brings us to a question from a listener, Tracy, at the Capitol, who asks about whether this could be a colossal embarrassment if lawmakers go home without doing anything.
You know, I've had that asked me. I don't know if that's the case. It's. I think the public expects them to come here and do their job, and sometimes they're successful in doing that. Sometimes they're not. But I don't know if I would call it a colossal failure. It may be perceived to be that by the people who would like to see the vetoes overturned. But I think generally the public is okay with the legislature convening and exercising their constitutional duties and debating and voting. So I don't think it's ever an embarrassment for the legislature to meet. And, you know, sometimes you just don't accomplish your goals. And look, we're all focused on this bill, and I understand why. It's the topic of the day and the topic of the week and the topic of this session. But, you know, you can go back and look at the session we just had. You know, nobody focuses on how many things the governor and the legislature worked together on. I mean, they worked together. Whether you like these issues or not, they did it. I mean, they did some significant tax reforms that people are going to be able to vote on this fall on the Constitution. They worked on a very successful, we hope, sports wagering structure. They worked on, distributing, I think, in a very judicious and conservative manner, the funds that we got from the American Rescue Plan. They mostly spent that one-time money, one-time expenditures. There's going to be a lot of money flowing to municipalities to deal with water issues. We're going to replenish our unemployment trust fund. So, you know, we all want to chase this issue, and I get it. It's sexy, and it's got a lot of attention to it. But there's a whole bunch of things they did that we just sort of tossed by the wayside because we want to talk about this. So the governor and the legislature actually did a lot of things together, and they ought to get credit for that.
Well, they did in the last session. You're right. Of course, yes. This is one of those times in which the state had money. That makes it a lot easier to come together. And it's a shame in some ways that the social issues are now causing a wedge. And of course, the governor will comment, and I suspect he's not pleased about this development of an override session, but he may come away the victor. They may have overplayed their hand. And even if it is overridden, this debate will not end today, no matter what happens.
No.
Jennifer and Tara. Jennifer, you're on with Jim. Hi, Jennifer. Good morning to you. Okay. Did we lose her? Looks like we did. Thank you, Jennifer. If you call back, we'll slide you in. 877-217-5757. Another listener asked Jim, this is IL, about the 28 vetoes. They're all potentially fertile for review. Is there any prospect that something else will be presented in the last few days of this veto session?
I don't know. I don't think the Senate has much appetite, as we saw yesterday, to override on anything else. And so the House has to determine whether they want to make a number of votes that some would perceive as futile because there's no appetite for it in the Senate. And that's a decision I would suspect the Speaker and a lot of his leadership are looking at right now and trying to determine how many times do you want to be on the record overturning a governor that you have to work with for the next few years on an issue that you are pretty certain is not going to even get voted on in the Senate. So, I think it's these, again, I said it at the beginning of our interview, these are new times, they're interesting times. This is uncharted territory politically. And look, there's some uncharted territory policy-wise. How many times can they take a vote on a veto override? There are some that say, hey, the governor gets one veto, you get one vote. There's others that say, hey, in the past, there was more than one vote on an override. It failed. But so, some of this is going to end up in court, maybe, on whether or not these vetoes are, so it's all uncharted territory. This is not easy for these political leaders to deal with. And so the direct answer to your question is this looks like the only one to me, but I'm not in the building. I'm not in the room, so I don't know for certain.
And we're eager to get the governor's review of this today at 2 o'clock on Ask the Governor, his 64th.
Which show, I knew you were going to know the number, 64th. That's a pretty impressive run.
Yeah, he's perhaps the only governor in the country who does this sort of thing, and he takes people who often disagree with him. But a listener said, we played Karen Carter Peterson. Why haven't we played somebody who spoke in favor of the override? Matt Doyle has chosen Big Mike Fessy of HOMA. Senator Fessy, here we go.
You know, it's always hearing about what money we're going to lose. It's always about money to change minds. It's always about money to do this. But what about our morals? What about our good, decent morals? This bill is not against anyone. It does not discriminate against anyone. But this bill is about our daughters, our granddaughters, and all women's rights to be fair to sports.
All right. If you'd like to get in under the wire, 877-217-5757. They're sincere people like Senator Fessy and Gene Mills who really are passionate about this. I guess they believe that this has implications that go far beyond trans people competing against others in a competition, Jim.
Yeah, what's interesting, and I've heard this from lawyers, I'm not a lawyer, is currently the LHSAA, it's my understanding, has a prohibition against transgender athletes. It's in place. If you were to try to change that, you would have to go to court. The only entities that could go to court that would have standing in such a litigation would be a member of the LHSAA. The members of the LHSAA are the actual schools. So I have three daughters. Let's say I wanted to sue to overturn this policy that the LHSAA has. I don't think I could go to court and do that. I would have to ask my school to do that. Okay? So if they override this veto and it becomes law, it's my appreciation, and I don't know if this is accurate, you can ask the governor about it, individuals would then have standing in court. So it may make people more, may make schools and the LHSAA more vulnerable to having to allow these trans. I don't know if that's accurate or not. The governor may be able to explain that better, but it's an interesting topic and people are very passionate about it. And, some of it is pushback just on there are people that fear the culture of our society is changing so rapidly. And it is. I talk about it a lot with my clients and a lot with my family and with my friends. The pace of change in our society, economically, socially, is very rapid right now. And it gives people anxiety, and I get that, and they want to push back on it, and this is an issue they've chosen to do that on, and we have to respect those perspectives.
The concealed carry measure, it failed. It did get a majority, and that's one of those that could come up for a second vote, but I doubt that another three votes could be amassed. One of those who switched was Franklin Foyle, who was with us a few days ago from Baton Rouge, and represents a district largely populated by LSU people. Was that a surprise, Jim?
No. Well, I never spoke to Senator Fall. He is my senator. I wasn't a surprise because I wasn't sure what he was going to do one way or the other. But I'm sure he heard from a lot of people in his district that heard probably Sheriff Gautreau and heard law enforcement people say, look, we're a little concerned that we're going to allow people to conceal carry without some training and some permit. Here's my issue with the whole carrying of guns, and it's pretty simple. Not everybody's a good shot, okay? There's very few people that aim well. So my problem is if everybody's packing and some nut comes in a restaurant or the Capitol and starts shooting and everybody else starts shooting, I'm going to get hit by somebody who's a bad aim. I mean, the reason I want people to go get trained is I want, if they're going to shoot, make sure you hit the guy or the gal that's got the gun. Don't hit me. So, you know, people say the criminal element has guns, so we should have guns. And I understand that people want to protect their home and their families. But if you're going to do that, man, make sure you're a good shot. Don't hit me by accident. And the more guns that are out there, the more bullets are flying, the more bullets are flying, the more chances somebody innocently is going to get hit. So I just, you know, not everybody's got Blake Miguez's aim, I'm afraid.
William in Opelousas. William, you're on with Jim Nickel. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Jim. Good morning, Mr. Nickel. Jim,
hey, William.
I'm trying to understand where they're having problems with this transgender issue, because I don't know what state they're having problems in. What are they having problems with it in college or in the pros? I'm not aware of anything. So what's the big deal with this transgender issue?
All right. What is the catalyst for this? Some would say it's just a way to try to make hay with the conservative base. Is that part of this? There has to be a political component to this, Jim.
Oh, well, look, both sides on this issue and on the gun issue, all these interest groups on both sides of the aisle do take the opportunity to have these issues, generate membership, generate dues, generate contributions. I mean, that goes on both sides. So you can't really say just the conservatives do that or just the liberals do that. These issues do tend to provide those opportunities to build membership and things of that nature. I'm not saying that's why. Senator Mizell is very sincere in this issue. And trust me, she was probably under a tremendous amount of pressure to not bring it up. She was probably asked by her colleagues, and I don't know this, to please let this go. She felt passionately about it. She's the elected senator from her district. She has the right to do it. And that's the way the process is set up. And that's how democracy works. And sometimes it's not pretty. Sometimes we don't understand it, but it's still the best one we got.
We'll be back to spend a few more minutes with Jim Nickel of Corson Nickel, one of the top lobbying firms in Louisiana. And he'll assess the session and more in our remaining time with him. And then Dr. Christine Montross on what's happening in our prison system. Back after this 2-minute timeout. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. In a few moments, we're going to hear from Dr. Christine Montross, who has a new book that has been singled out as a book to watch for July by the New York Times about America's prison system. But we're finishing up with Jim Nickel, veteran lobbyist and former head of the Democratic Party in Louisiana. And a listener, Tom, on Bluebonnet did ask about the Democratic Party right now. With a weak hand, only the governor of our state is the only statewide elected Democrat, and he, as we mentioned, is dealing with an overwhelmingly Republican legislature. Tom asks about 2023, which is not that far away. Do Democrats have any chance whatsoever of retaining the governorship, or is that a lost cause, Jim Nickel?
Well, I don't know if it's a lost cause. It's a long shot. I mean, it's, you know, this is obviously become a very red state. President Trump was successful. Former President Trump was successful both times. We do look at governor's races a little different in Louisiana than we do national races. And so there's a formula out there to get it done. We saw it. John Bel Edwards did it. I haven't heard a name yet that leads me to believe that he or she is putting together the type of campaign that would be successful. But, you know, John Bel Edwards, state representative from Ames, Louisiana, pulled it together at the right time against the right opponent, pulled it off. So it's possible, but right now I would say it's a long shot.
Nobody's approached you?
No, nobody's approached me.
Well, Jim Nickel would be a formidable candidate if he were to enter. And he's still young enough to do it, but that's probably a long shot too. Thank you, Jim.
Yes.
Always a pleasure.
Hey, thank you, buddy.
See you soon.
All the best to you and your listeners. All right, bye-bye.
We're joined now by Dr. Christine Montross. 2015 Guggenheim Fellow in General Nonfiction, Associate Professor of Psychiatry at Brown University, and a practicing inpatient psychiatrist. She is writing about our prison system, and certainly mental illness is a big part of people who are incarcerated in this country. And Dr. Montross notes that on an average day, over 450,000 people are held in pretrial detention in America. Her book is Waiting for an Echo, The Madness of American Incarceration. Dr. Montross, good morning.
Good morning.
Your thoughts about, particularly in the COVID age, how the mentally ill are being affected by incarceration in America. Is this the best way to address crime issues in our world as we know it?
It's not. So I work as an inpatient psychiatrist in a freestanding psychiatric hospital, and I work on the intensive treatment units there. It's like the psychiatric version of the ICU. So the patients I treat are hearing voices and seeing visions. They're very paranoid, or they're actively trying to hurt themselves or other people. And what I've found over my years of working with them is that they often come in contact with police, and they sometimes serve time in our nation's jails and prisons. And in talking to them about what happens when they're there, they often end up there because of their symptoms, not because of any criminal intent. They're shouting in the Starbucks or charging through TSA because they have a delusional belief about a flight they need to catch. And then once they're in those punitive environments rather than therapeutic environments, the results can be really disastrous.
Dr. Christine Montross is with us, 877-217-5757, if you would like to join our conversation. Her book is Waiting for an Echo, The Madness of American Incarceration. You write that people with mental illness are 16 times more likely to be killed in a police encounter than people who are, quote, psychiatrically well. Why is this such an issue?
You know, people in psychiatric emergencies can be volatile and unpredictable. That's a difficult situation, especially if the people responding to those emergencies haven't had training about how to de-escalate psychiatric situations. So part of it is that. But the other part is, I think, shining light on a real discrepancy in how we respond to health emergencies. If you're in a car accident or you're having a heart attack and you call 911, the people who show up to treat you are trained clinicians who can start IVs or administer oxygen. They stabilize fractures and they get you to a hospital for medical treatment. If you call 911 in the midst of a psychiatric emergency, as many concerned family members do, it's the police who show up. And we ought to have clinicians who are trained to handle psychiatric emergencies, just like we have clinicians who are trained to handle healthcare emergencies. So I think part of the problem arises in that very first moment of the police encounter, rather than having that be a clinical encounter.
And you also make note of the fact that loved ones of mentally ill people, Dr. Montross, they often have few options as to what to do.
There's no question about that. And I think that the responsibility here doesn't lie squarely on police. We also in our society have cut mental health funding over and over again so that there is a real paucity of psychiatric beds available. We have a real difficulty with people being able to obtain the outpatient treatment that they require. So people who are mentally ill are more frequently in emergency settings. And I've had police talk to me about the fact that sometimes if they take a mentally ill person to a psychiatric hospital or an emergency room, that there are no beds available and that person is discharged. If they then resume the problematic behavior they were doing that got the police called in the first place, this time the police will take them to jail, and jail has an ironclad no refusal policy. And I even hear police talk about compassionate arrest, where they will arrest someone who's mentally ill because they say, at least in that situation, I know the person has three hots and a cot and someone will get them their medications and make sure that they're breathing. But we would never arrest someone to make sure that they got their insulin for their diabetes. We would never arrest someone to be sure that they got their chemotherapy.
The book, again, is Waiting for an Echo from Dr. Christine Montross, and galvanized by her work through the years in our nation's jails. Dr. Montross, who, as we noted, is a psychiatrist, reveals the psychological toll of incarceration, examining the ongoing human crisis within America's policing system. Now, COVID-19 has worsened prison conditions, and there is a statistic that some may be surprised by, that in your book, COVID rates among incarcerated people are more than 5 times the national average. What is the contributing factor to this?
It's impossible to socially distance if you're in an overcrowded prison. So detainees and correctional officers alike were highly susceptible and vulnerable to COVID. And when we, you know, I think one of the things that the pandemic provided was a rare moment of empathic connection and understanding for those of us who live free lives. On the one hand, to know how helpless many of us felt in being able to protect ourselves from COVID, and then thinking about if you didn't have the ability to socially distance, if you were even less available to be able to protect your family, but also then to understand the psychological effects that many of us felt from the social isolation of the pandemic. When you're not able to go visit someone who you love who is in the hospital and suffering with an illness, when you're not able to attend the funeral of someone that you love, when you're not able to see children, grandchildren, parents, and grandparents, many Americans suffered from depression and anxiety as a result of this. But it offers us a glimpse of what we do intentionally when we incarcerate people. We separate people on purpose from these really critical moments of human connection that make us all healthy and well. And so it was a moment also of understanding that we do psychologically damage people when we put them in these institutional settings and disrupt the human bonds that all of us need to maintain our mental health.
A listener, Hal in Monroe, asks about the rate of vaccination in prisons. Are prisoners being vaccinated the way the general public is? And as we know, in some places, including Louisiana, many people are not being vaccinated. How is it for inmates?
It varies widely from prison to prison. Many states have made vaccinating prisoner detainees and correctional officers a priority, but there's a lot of misinformation and misunderstanding in those settings as well. Many people believe, well, because I already had COVID, I don't need to be vaccinated, which of course from a healthcare standpoint we know is not the case. In addition, I spent some time volunteering as a physician to talk with immigration detainees who really felt a mistrust for the information that they were getting about the vaccine. So I think it's hard for detainees to trust the authorities who are telling them information about the safety of the vaccine. So there's been reticence in those communities to accept the vaccine, just as there has been when there's been misinformation in non-prison communities as well.
Prison personnel required in most places to be vaccinated, or is that an optional matter?
It really varies as well. Yeah, it depends. Just as it's varying in our universities and our healthcare settings, it varies from prison to prison also.
This is not an easy topic, even for somebody who delves into psychiatry every day, as you do. Was it a draining endeavor to write about this?
You know, I think it felt important to me. You know, I think just because it's difficult to look at a topic doesn't mean we ought not look at it. On the other hand, I also found a great deal of hope in researching Waiting for an Echo. Two primary things emerged for me. One was, at a time when there's hardly any bipartisan agreement on anything, Republicans and Democrats alike agree that we need prison reform in our country. The system is ineffective, it's inefficient, it's expensive, and it's inhumane. And so you have things like Cory Booker and Newt Gingrich on stage together at a conference speaking about the need for prison reform. That's incredibly hopeful for me. You also have places in the world that are doing this differently and doing it well. So there are models in Scandinavia and elsewhere of countries that have revamped their prison system with wonderful results. And
I do have to roll, but it's Waiting for an Echo, an important book from Dr. Christine Montross. Until tomorrow, First Financial provides signature support for Talk Louisiana.